Toolkit to plot against U.S. unions. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid video production fellowships, as well as a variety of paid internships. Find out more at democracynow.org. I'll be speaking at University of California, Santa Cruz, Thursday night. That's May 17th at 7 o'clock with Dan Ellsberg. You can check our website for details at the 910 Multipurpose Room at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Trina Ndura, and Nat Needham. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gudars, and Karl Marxer. You can sign up for our daily digest by texting the word Democracy Now!, one word, to 66866. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pueblo Unido PDX one-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Join Portlanders in celebrating the recent success and helping community members win their cases against deportation and get out of immigration detentions. This event will feature a reception with the silent auction, raffle, light refreshments, and more. Again, that's the Pueblo Unido PDX one-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Nat Turner Project book release on Thursday, May 24th at 6:30 p.m. at City Hall in Portland. The Nat Turner Project allows artists of color to go beyond the usual initial expositions inherent in presenting art born of marginalized perspectives to a dominant culture and creates an environment of inclusivity, a communal harbor for artists previously silenced by institutional constraints, and actively provides priority spaces to artists of color. Their first catalog, titled Nat Turner Project Testimony, will be released and celebrated with food, drink, and music. Again, that's the Nat Turner Project book release on Thursday, May 24th at 6:30 p.m. at City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
the show. This is a Wednesday talk radio. I'm Paul Rowland. As always, every Wednesday morning, 8 to 9, the other days of the week, you get somebody else, and or some other two people sometimes even. And sometimes I have guests, sometimes I don't. This is one of those times I don't. I'm here all by myself, so I'd like your company at 503-231-8187. Give me a few minutes to talk about a few things to kind of get the wheels turning here. Let's see, I had an announcement. What did I do with it? Oh, no. Oh, no. Michael Pollan is going to be at the Newmark Theater coming up next Wednesday, May 23rd. And I just copied off. Oh, here it is. Please excuse me. I heard him on Terry Gross, Fresh Air, last night. Anybody else listen to that show? She's still pretty damn good. Author Michael Pollan is coming to Portland to speak about psychedelics. Pollan will be reading from his new book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. His early works, The Botany of Desire and The Omnivore's Dilemma, catapulted him into food writing fame. His blend of science, nutrition, memoir, and travel writing, his palatably radical opinions on what people should be eating, solidified him as a household name. Then in 2015, he entered the world of psychedelics with a New York Times piece about microdosing. The TRIP treatment followed terminal cancer patients through experimental psilocybin treatments and examined how this hallucinogen helped them process their fear of dying. I like to immerse myself in whatever subject I'm reporting. What began as a third-person journalistic inquiry ended up a first-person quest to learn what these medicines had to teach me, not only about the mind, but also my mind, and specifically about the nature of spiritual experience. So that should be quite extraordinary. He's going to be at the Newmark Theater on Southwest Broadway, Wednesday, May 23rd, 7:30 p.m. You can go to portland5.com. There's also a phone number, but I can give that to you if you want to call me up at the front desk where I reside after this show. If you didn't know that, you can call me and talk to me there. If I'm not busy, be willing to talk to you. That's a different number. Let's not confuse things too much. So Muse started us off. Apocalypse, please declare this an emergency. Come on and spread a sense of urgency and pull us through and pull us through. And this is the end. This is the end of the world, and it's time we saw a miracle. Come on, it's time for something biblical. That seemed appropriate as I immersed myself in articles about, well, about the apocalypse, specifically in the context of, well, what's going on in Gaza is certainly apocalyptic to those people who are being killed and maimed by the Israel Defense Forces. Because they threaten the conscience of Israel, who upon their founding kicked out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, very similar to the way this country treated its indigenous inhabitants, the indigenous inhabitants. Very strong parallels there. Look at South Africa, Israel, and the United States, all settler colonial states. The rights and wrongs, the history of the founding of Israel is a complex and important discussion. What I want to look at today is this strange apocalyptic thinking that allies these right-wing evangelicals with their right-wing Zionist counterparts in Israel, and where some of that thinking comes from, and how Trump's decision to move the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem fits into that. And I'll just give you a few of these titles, as I sometimes do when I do shows like this. Anyway, side note, you know, the embassy actually didn't actually move yet. It's really kind of strange to hear all the reporting. All the reports say, oh, it moved. It was really just a kind of a big show there to do that on the, you know, the around the anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. And they didn't report the fact that it actually operationally, you know, it has work hasn't been finished. And anyway, that's a little side note. Okay, so what I've been reading here, End Times, the Prosperity Gospel, and Trump, kind of follows up on my interview with Chris Layman on his book, The Money Cult, talked a lot about the prosperity gospel, this strange confluence of this rather relatively new, although it has deep roots, but what we know is a prosperity gospel. The name actually is fairly new, but it has deep roots, as he talks about it, going back to the first and second great awakenings in the United States. Anyway, so the confluence of the prosperity gospel and this end times thinking is important to understand, I think. The apocalyptic thinking in the age of Trump, America is ready for the end times. Kind of the theme, apocalypse, please. People seem to be wishing for it. Evangelicals and ISIS feel fine about the end of the world. End times prophecies for evangelicals and the Islamic State are eerily similar. God help us if they ever become self-fulfilling. Armageddon 101, the true history of the end of the world from Haaretz. I should guess read where all these things are from. I will make a program page after the fact and list all these. Rapture anxiety calls out evangelicals' toxic obsession with the end times from Vox, from Trump's Jerusalem decision to Roy Moore's campaign this week. This is from December of last year. Has triggered many evangelicals' anxieties about the apocalypse and many others. Many, many others. This is a theme that a lot of people are mining. Let me just read one more. Half of evangelicals support Israel because they believe it is important for fulfilling end times prophecy. Okay, this is on the road to Armageddon, how evangelicals became Israel's best friend. This is adapted with permission by BeliefNet website from On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend by Timothy Weber. In a recent Time CNN poll, more than one-third of Americans said that since the terrorist attacks of 9/11, they have been thinking more about how current events might be leading to the end of the world. While only 36% of all Americans believe that the Bible is God's word and should be taken literally, 59% say they believe that events predicted in the book of Revelation will come to pass. It's kind of an odd fact in a way, if you think about it. Almost one out of four Americans believes that 9/11 was predicted in the Bible, and nearly one in five believes that he or she will live long enough to see the end of the world. Even more significant for this study, over one-third of those Americans who support Israel report that they do so because they believe the Bible teaches that the Jews must possess their own country in the Holy Land before Jesus can return. Millions of Americans believe that the Bible predicts the future and that we are living in the last days. Their beliefs are rooted in dispensationalism, a particular way of understanding the Bible's prophetic passages, especially those in Daniel and Ezekiel in the Old Testament and the book of Revelation in the New Testament. They make up about one-third of America's 40 or 50 million evangelical Christians and believe that the nation of Israel will play a central role in the unfolding of end times events. In the last part of the 20th century, dispensationalist evangelicals have become Israel's best friends, an alliance that has made a serious geopolitical difference. During times of turmoil and world crisis, many people who ordinarily do not pay the Bible any mind are attentive to Bible teachers who use signs of the times to explain where history is headed. I would add, people don't just turn to the Bible, as this article about ISIS, people turn to other texts, and some people, you know, have direct revelation or, you know, find golden tablets, like a certain founder of a homegrown religion here in the United States. Anyway, there's many ways of responding to crisis. Okay, let me continue. Though dispensationalists fine-tune their prophetic interpretations as needed over time, they retain their core belief about the role of Jews in the last days. For over 100 years, their insistence on the restoration of the Jewish state in the Holy Land seemed far-fetched. But after the founding of Israel in 1948 and its expansion after the Six-Day War, dispensationalists promoted their ideas with the confidence that Bible prophecy was being fulfilled for all to see. Starting in the 1970s, dispensationalists broke into the popular culture with runaway bestsellers and a well-networked political campaign to promote and protect the interests of Israel. Since the mid-1990s, tens of millions of people who have never seen a prophetic chart or listened to a sermon on the Second Coming have read one or more novels of the Left Behind series, which has become the most effective disseminator of dispensationalist ideas ever. Before the founding and expansion of Israel, dispensationalists were more or less content to teach their doctrine, look for signs of the times, and predict in sometimes great detail what was going to happen in the future. They believed that they would be raptured before most end times events actually took place, but they expected to be here long enough to see history moving decisively in a predetermined direction. In essence, they sat high in the bleachers on history's 50-yard line, watching as various teams took their positions on the playing field below and explaining how the game was going to end. But all that changed after Israel reclaimed its place in Palestine and expanded its borders. For the first time, dispensationalists believed that it was necessary to leave the bleachers and get onto the playing field to make sure the game ended according to the divine script. The biggest story in the years following the Six-Day War was how dispensationalists organized to support Israel in the face of the forces arrayed against it. Now that Jews were home, quote home, they have it in quotes, in the land of Israel and had expanded beyond its 1948 borders, dispensationalists became committed to keeping them there. During the early 1980s, the Israeli Ministry of Tourism recruited evangelical religious leaders for free, quote, familiarization tours. In time, hundreds of evangelical pastors got free trips to the Holy Land. The purpose of such promotional tours was to enable people of even limited influence to experience Israel for themselves and be shown how they might bring their own tour group to Israel. The Ministry of Tourism was interested in more than tourist dollars. Here was a way of building a solid core of non-Jewish supporters for Israel in the United States by bringing large numbers of evangelicals to hear and see Israel's story for themselves. The strategy caught on. Getting American evangelicals to travel to Israel was only half of the Israeli strategy. The other half was to create a politically engaged pro-Israel force among conservative American Christians in the United States. Shortly after the Six-Day War, elements within the Israeli government saw the potential power of the evangelical subculture and began to mobilize it as a base of support that could influence American foreign policy. The Israeli government sent Yonah Malachi of its Department of Religious Affairs to the United States to study American fundamentalism and its potential as an ally of Israel. Malachi was warmly received by fundamentalists and was able to influence some of them to issue strong pro-Israeli manifestos. By the mid-1980s, there was a discernible shift in the Israeli political strategy. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, the Jewish state's major lobbying group in Washington, D.C., started realigning itself with the American political right wing, including Christian conservatives. Israel's timing was perfect. It began working seriously with American dispensationalists at the precise moment that American fundamentalists and evangelicals were discovering their political voice. It packs a bunch of history into a mere two pages. On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend. That's, again, adapted from this book. On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend. Just what I said. And that's on BeliefNet website is where I found that. And again, I'd like to read some from some of these others. I'd like to engage you. I guess before we get deep into that, I just want to flag that kind of different subject, but I actually thought of how to relate it. I saw an amazing documentary on Netflix in the last few days, Rachel Carson, part of the American Experience series on PBS, made last year. God, what a woman. I just can't believe I never really focused in on what a monumental woman, human being, Rachel Carson, was, and what incredible influence and how she fought against all odds as a woman to study science, as a sole individual to go against the chemical industry, the mighty force of the still mighty force. Monsanto is featured in that. It's so grim. The endless onslaught of images of people, you know, spraying individual sprays in the house, of huge foggers, crop dusters. It just really hits you how massively we were dosing ourselves with DDT and other pesticides, and still are. She didn't have as much of an effect as perhaps she could have. Well, let's go to our first caller. Lou, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
So it sounds like you're on the apocalypse and doomsday political scenarios between the right wing and Israel.
Uh-huh.
In general. So I went to the Poor People's Campaign meeting Monday in Salem, and a couple of us tried to mention Palestine as an important current political problem that's happening. And there are poor people in Palestine. But I'm not sure if you're keeping track a lot of Poor People's Campaign, but it's basically trying to do civil disobedience against the Trump agenda, and it's in like about 40 states. So it seems to be fairly active in Oregon. They're doing another thing in Salem next Monday. But I'm curious if you have a thought about, in terms of...
Well, I was curious how that was received. You introduced it by saying that you mentioned that to the group. How was it received?
Well, there is about 100 people there, and Peter Bergel, who's a longtime peace activist in Salem. They were polite, but they were just kind of saying later. They weren't focused on that. The criticism I hear from anti-poverty organizers in Portland is that there's not enough poor people in their particular movement in this state, which may be a good or a bad criticism. So basically it was, without anything formal, it wasn't Robert's Rules, but there are 100 people there. Basically it was just tabled, which isn't necessarily bad. I'd much rather see activists, even if they're pacifists on the left, doing something. That's good. But I'm curious if, in terms of your topic, if films, if you've seen either Denial, which is a recent film about Holocaust denial, or an older film called The Rapture, which sounds like it's more specifically addressed to what you've been reading and discussing so far yourself.
No, I actually haven't. But now you've mentioned them, I will. I would like to. I tend to watch things on Netflix because that's what I got.
Sure.
Or you know the art films. You know, the art film circuit here in or whatever, independent films in Portland.
Right.
But those older films. Yeah, talk about those films.
Well, I may have mentioned, I've called in your program once or twice. At Portland State, we have a Progressive Film Fest. And we do have a copy of Denial, but we don't have a copy of The Rapture. The Rapture might be specifically, it's a dramatization, and it's fictional. It hasn't happened yet. But it was probably 20 years ago. It has Mimi Rogers, who is, I think, Tom Cruise's first spouse. And Bruno Ganz, who's a really good German actor. And as I recall, the basic structure, in a nutshell, was The Rapture is coming. And it was people were, in some ways, a lot like Donald Trump. They were totally into, what would you call it, nihilism, women, wife swapping. Not that necessarily these things are bad, but kind of consuming as much as possible. In terms of relationships or sex, because the rapture was coming. And the choice of these two individuals as a fictional story was, did they want to sacrifice a son to prove that they really believed the rapture happened? And as I recall, they decide that's what they do. So that sounds like pretty dramatization of the prophetic nature of, if you believe in something that's horrific, why are you, and it's not really a discussion film. It doesn't ask, well, why is it so important for Christian American evangelicals to support either the idea of the rapture or support Israel's foreign and domestic policy. The other film, Denial, is actually more geared towards stuff that we worked on at a PSU in Portland with a specific local thing. Denial's also a dramatization, has Rachel Weisz, and I found a book of it, I'll look through it, that was written by a woman history teacher, I believe in Georgia, who was sued by one of the primary Holocaust deniers like 20 years ago. And so this film, Denial, came out a year ago. It's on DVD. I don't know if Netflix has it. But it's basically showing how this Holocaust denier used courts in England to sue the history teacher because apparently the proof of valid accusations is far weaker in England. So if you assert the Holocaust did happen, this guy, Holocaust denier, sued the teacher who asserted it did happen. So the film is like piece by piece about, well, it's the most well-documented event in history, and our local...
Oh, yeah, I am familiar with that. I must have read a review of that, because I'm familiar with that story, that court case and the difference in law. That rings a bell. You know, just don't mean to cut you off. I'm curious. You know, this is such a weighted issue, and I'm not sure if wading into it here is the best or wisest thing to do. But, you know, the whole... where did I read recently the idea that you know, Israel plays upon the Holocaust to justify its actions? I mean, to really utterly simplify it, is a theme. You know, I can't even tell you how much that actually does really exist. But you know, there's people who, you know, from all the way from Holocaust deniers to, you know, well-thinking people like you and I can entertain such thoughts, you know, that there's a political use of the Holocaust that can and might happen. I was wondering what you think about that.
Well, the evangelical right, which is probably a global movement, not just the U.S. or Israel, uses and has probably historically for a while the notion of an exceptionalism. So at this point, at PSU and our group, we'll say, well, who are the most right-wing governments in the world within certain parameters? United States and Israel. And apparently Trump now, in particular, Republicans have always done this, but Trump is Republicanism personified, feels that the U.S. can do whatever it wants, either to poor people in this country or supporting the alleged move of the embassy to Jerusalem in support of Israel. I think there's a name for it in history, but it's like if your particular group or nation feels isolated or historically trashed, and genocide in World War II was, along with anti-Semitism for centuries, a way for Israel to feel like, okay, well, this is our saying never again, you know, that we'll have the Zionist state and therefore we can do whatever we want in that geographic area, regardless of human rights. In the United States, from, I don't know, maybe World War II, Noam Chomsky would probably be the best source, Vietnam War in particular, which apparently 3 million people died because they were seen as other, and there was a rationale about fighting that war. And all the little wars, quote-unquote, since then, the United States has supported. So, yeah, I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, that's a good way along. Listen, there's someone queued up,
sure.
And probably other people.
That's
fine.
Thanks.
Appreciate.
Bye.
Yeah, okay. He always gets off so abruptly. But that's good. I like to have extended conversations occasionally. It's hard to just talk in 2 or 3 minute bites, so it's nice to step out a little bit. So yeah, that was Lou. We got another caller. Hold on just a second. We're talking about apocalyptic thinking in the age of Trump. We're talking about evangelicals' support of Israel and how that, really the fundamental point is how that enables and buttresses and hardens Israelis' positions, you know, in addition to massive influxes of U.S. military might in terms of arms sales and technology transfer, is, I guess, the material support. The ideological support comes in various forms, but growing importance in the past couple decades, as I outlined in the article I just read, is the evangelical support based upon these ideas supposedly based in Scripture. Of course, some say you can find whatever you want in the Bible. That might be a stretch, but you can certainly interpret widely. And the idea that certain things have to take place before Jesus can return, and you know, there's even great differences amongst people who think that way. There's a pre-tribulationist, post-tribulationist, all this wild stuff. I think it comes from a certain desperation. Dispensationalism actually goes back to our Puritan roots. Cotton Mather, actually, it's actually apparently an American invention, that specific end times. There wasn't, you know, the whole idea of the Antichrist. Anyway, this stuff, read up on it. I think it explains a lot. I think we have another caller, though. Who's that, Liam? Brian, go ahead. You're on the air if you're still with us.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, this is an interesting conversation, and appreciate you having it. A little earlier, you said something about the whole moving of the embassy in Israel, and you said that it's not actually happening, that it's just sort of a, you know, they're making it sound like it's happening.
No, that it's happening, but it hadn't physically happened.
It hasn't taken place really yet. And you said something like, well, that's not important. And I think it is important. You're kind of belittling your own like news. And I was glad that you brought that out.
No, so I didn't. What did I say?
It hasn't really happened yet, has it? Even though they made it on all the news channels sound like it had. And that's part of that whole, you know, Trumpian, you know, news story stuff that's just all fake. Anyway, I just appreciated you bringing that out, and just wanted to tell you I appreciate you brought that out. And then the thing I was going to do, and I hope this isn't too tangential, but I think it's fitting. I think a lot of the people that listen to KBOO are kind of stuck in this whole rational thinking and being educated mindset, and don't necessarily have an idea of how this other thought process happens when around some of the biblical teachings that you're talking about today. And I grew up, I was a Baptist minister's son, but in the church that I grew up in, it wasn't terribly Pentecostal, but there would be elements of that would come in from time to time. And my father actually struggled with that, because he was from, I would call him more of like a Jimmy Carter Baptist. But one time in the church that we attended, he was no longer preaching, and they were actually looking for a new pastor, and they had different people coming through to do sermons to kind of see how they did. And they got a young man that was actually a GI on base that had been to Tennessee Bible College, and he preached one Sunday. And I remember I was 16 years old, and this was like 1977, I guess. And it was during one of the oil embargoes. Anyway, he's preaching, and of course he's preaching from Revelations, and he gets to a passage, and for years I've been wanting to find this passage again. Of course, I can't remember the exact passage, but he found the passage, and in it, in, of course, English, in James, King James Bible, it said something about the spoils of war, and he got to that passage, and he had a long, pregnant pause, and then he asked the congregation, "What do you see in that passage? Do you see the word spoils?" And everybody nodded their head and said, "In that word, do you see the word oil?" And, you know, you see some people nodding. And as a 16-year-old, I looked around, and I was just dumbfounded at what I was hearing. And I looked around, and the congregation of rational people that I knew and were friends of ours were just kind of sitting there nodding their head and accepting this. And that was a big turning point in my life, where I decided that I was going to turn away from this. Anyway, that's just kind of an idea for people out there to understand that where some of these people are coming from is just like mind-boggling.
In a way, you know, one thing I'm getting from what you're saying is the sort of the way things sometimes can shift under your feet without you necessarily, you know, if you buy into, well, if you grow up Christian, you grow up a churchgoer, you grow up with, and then, you know, maybe a new pastor comes along and, you know, you mean them well, but they have a different message. And maybe, I think sometimes that is what happens, in addition to, you know, people being born into these situations and a lot of them just, you know, going along with it, or in your case, you know, rejecting it eventually. But I think that sometimes we don't realize that, you know, we sort of, as you're saying, we think of these people as sort of irrational and like just as sort of these other beings somehow, or just
they're not necessarily crazies. They're people that are good to their children, and they have a good job, and they're community members, and then go to church and have somebody tell them that the end of times is coming because there's oil in the word spoils. You know,
and then they vote for Trump, maybe.
Yeah, and of course that was the end of times. Now is 30 whatever or 40, 41 years ago. So it's like it hasn't happened yet. But yeah, it's mind-boggling, and it's not exactly encouraging. You know, it's because how do you deal with that? I mean, how do you? Somebody on one hand is talking rationally about things that are going on from a day-to-day basis, what, you know, what they need to do for the day, yet they can go accept this kind of thinking on Sunday, and I don't know, even though I came from sort of that culture, I don't know how to talk through it. I don't know how to communicate with it.
Well, maybe my a flippant response would be, you know, Michael Paul and I talked about is coming and talking about the use of psychedelics. Of course, that was the great fear. You know, people thought, oh, they're going to put LSD in the water supply. I mean, on the one side, that was sort of the great hope, you know, the great apostles of psychedelics like Timothy Leary. Oh, you know, if everybody just took it, would all be saved, you know. And then on the other side, this great sort of reactionary fear is sort of this, the culture war that, you know, it didn't start in the 60s, but sort of got rapidly accelerated in the 60s.
Right.
You know, between the long hairs and the straights and the drug takers and the not. And anyway, so yeah, my flippant response is, yeah, we need, in some ways, you know, it's almost like, it is almost like a cult, like Chris Lehman was talking about in this book, The Money Cult. You know, we're all bought into, you know, the capitalist cult. And some people are bought into the, you know, Christian evangelical cult. And yeah, how do you, you know, do we need deprogram? We don't have enough deprogrammers out there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess. And they probably think the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your show. I'll look forward to listening to the rest
of
it.
All right. Thank you for calling, Brian. And we have some lines open, 503-231-8187. Don't leave me here all by myself. I'll just start reading articles, actually, which are kind of interesting. How about this? Evangelicals and ISIS feel fine about the end of the world. This is a bit of a bombshell. It was to me anyway. Maybe there's a lot of you who've already thought this through. I mean, I've seen that, you know, people compared the Bundys to ISIS. There's even some funny sort of play on words about that. But okay, what if two mortal enemies both wanted a cataclysmic world-ending battle at roughly the same time in roughly the same place? Can you say self-fulfilling prophecy? As Americans become better acquainted with the apocalyptic beliefs of the Islamic State, thanks to a spate of recent presentations of them, it's worth noting that there are end timers on our side as well, whatever our side is. Over three quarters of U.S. evangelicals believe we're living, excuse me, in the end times right now. And while evangelical millennialists are not calling the military shots at the moment, their prophecies align in potentially terrifying ways with those of our enemy. I hear we got Mike on. Just hold on. Let me do another couple paragraphs or so. ISIS, as Graham Wood unveiled in The Atlantic recently. This is from 3 years ago, March 8, 2015. Is an apocalyptic death cult. ISIS, an apocalyptic death cult. It is Shinrikyu and the Branch Davidians, but with machine guns, brutality, and a swath of territory with 8 million people living in it. In parentheses, many have criticized Wood's article, but only that it does not emphasize enough that there are many other streams of Islam, that ISIS's brand is on the fringe, and that there are alternatives to Wood's literalistic reading of the Quran, which is fine and says nothing about his analysis of ISIS itself. Just one more paragraph here. ISIS's prophetic methodology, Wood's translation, involves not just a revanchist revival of slavery, crucifixion, and excommunication, but also the reestablishment of a territorial caliphate that is necessary for the coming of the Mahdi, the Messiah. Its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is said to be the 8th of 12 caliphs, which may mean that Armageddon will not take place for another few decades, or that the caliph's reigns may be short. Anyway, it just lays out this incredibly amazing parallel, both in terms of a specific place where this final battle is going to be, which is in Syria, not that far from Megiddo, which is in northern Israel. Anyway, read this article, Evangelicals and ISIS Feel Fine About the End of the World. And let's hear from Mike, what he has to say. Go ahead. Mike, are you still there with us?
Oh, good morning, KBU.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just a personal note. I had an experience, a real experience, although I'm not following any dogma out there. You know, the emotional, spiritual, physical needs of people are well established and documented, so this stuff is real, but not to be taken literally in stories. Obviously, everybody around the world has different poetry, but something struck me. I was 20 years ago, Pioneer Square, out on the bricks underneath the tent for Powell's bookstore, used bookstore, and I walk the tables, and you get into that mindset of searching, 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 looking with your head craned sideways and looking at book after title, and one struck out, jumped out at me. The title was very clear: "What if the Earth is the Messiah?" And I gasped, and I started crying immediately. That may be what's happening here. You know, it's not just our spirit and our religious belief. It's literally, maybe that was talking about civilization itself and our environment itself being sacrificed. Wow, it was very powerful, and it still sticks with me. I just wanted to share that personal
experience. Do you remember who the author of that book is?
Oh, I do not. I did not pick up that book. I did not buy that book. Maybe I wasn't ready for it.
Well, no, I'll check that out.
I don't know. Who knows? I mean, you know how emotions and spirituality, a lot of that stuff is really just recognizing outside yourself something that you already have inside yourself. So I felt like I already knew that, you know, it was confirming something in me, but it was shocking.
So basically, basically the idea that you got from it, as I take it, is that what's happening to the Earth is sort of an apocalyptic message for us, in a sense.
There may have been some insight into people around the world talking about things like that.
Well, yes, I just
it wasn't just about their one king; it was about their whole land. And maybe that's the fight we need to fight, not these differences between ideas of people and poetry, but look around us at the world that we are a part of. Guess what? You know, that's what we're sacrificing, and we don't need to sacrifice that stuff anymore. We're more rational than that. Anyway, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, I was hoping to engage you a little more, but thanks for bringing that in. Actually, that comes back to Rachel Carson. Because she certainly, there's certainly no discussion of apocalyptic thinking, but her thinking was informed by, very, very informed by nuclear, nuclear bombs and nuclear testing, and the massive effect, the disillusionment that came. It's interesting that I was listening to another thing on our public radio station. They've got something up. A podcast that they're starting on the Bundys, and they're actually talking about one thing that informed the Bundys' distrust of government was the Nevada test site, the nuclear testing that they, that everybody bought in. There's the Cold War thinking that people bought in to the, this need that, sure, there might be some, problems with it, but sacrifices must be made because of this the horrible Soviet threat that we had to, have this deterrence. And, it started to come out, the massive damage that nuclear testing was doing, from Nevada test site to the Bikini Atoll to wherever. And as a scientist, as a young scientist, a biologist, she had read an article about DDT, read some things about DDT early on. We're talking in, I think, in the 40s, and she actually proposed an article to, I forget what publication, and it was rejected. And she didn't really go back to that until the late 50s, and the result was a Silent Spring with the massive impact that that book had. But her thinking was heavily informed by the disaster of nuclear testing, or just the deployment of nuclear weapons, whether intentionally on people or through mostly atmospheric testing. Of course, underground testing has impacts as well. Anyway, the cumulative impact, and she saw a parallel between the use of pesticides and how they may not kill individual humans right away, but they have these massive cumulative effects on all life and the food chain, rising through the food chain, which is similar to the workings of nuclear energy. Anyway, that's a takeaway I had from that documentary. And certainly, you know, my involvement in Earth First was tinged by all these ideas of the catastrophes that we are wreaking on ourselves in the natural world. Anyway, we have three lines open, 503-231-8187. Got 15 minutes left. So if you want to call and talk to me about any of these things, I'd love to hear from you. Another book I read recently was Abby Hoffman's biography by his brother, Jack. Run, run, run. Just saying, Abby Hoffman. It's coming up on coming up on the anniversary of Chicago 68 pretty darn soon. And it'll be just 30 years since he died, I believe, coming up in April of next year. Abby Hoffman, another American, I don't want to say hero, but remarkable human being for all his flaws. So yeah, we're talking about Armageddon. We're talking about evangelicals. You know, it is a subject that we tend to resist. I think it's a key. I think that the money cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream by Chris Layman is a must-read book. And I think in conjunction with understanding this end times thinking, which, as I said, also goes back to the Puritans, I think is a powerful way of understanding the peculiarities of the United States of America. It's really sometimes hard to get a perspective on how peculiar we really are as a nation, you know, if we should claim our being a part of this nation, which I guess it's kind of hard to do if you're born and raised here like I was. I feel a certain distance. I think I've freed myself to a certain extent from this bizarre American exceptionalism, this idea of the America as a city on a hill and all that. Well, enough about my way of thinking. Let's go to Aaron. You're on the air. Hey, Aaron.
Yes.
Oh, Barry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, sure. Okay. I was wanting to bring up the book Solving 9/11. The fall of the World Trade Center.
Uh-huh.
And this, let's see. It's by Christopher Bolin, and it's everything that's being spoken of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, who am I speaking with?
Well, you know, this is Paul. I'm the host of Wednesday Talk Radio.
Oh yeah, I guess I had my radio on. It sounded a little bit different, but this has everything in it. What's been happening and all that stuff. Solving 9/11 by Christopher Bolin.
Okay.
And it goes into the political support. It Israel messing around with countries inside countries, and then the idea of. Computer technology and stuff like that in our system of I'll get the radio phones, headphones off of the in our system of military and let's see, our system of what do I our entire governmental system, military and treasury and all that stuff.
Okay, that's, solving 9/11 by Christopher Bowen. Appreciate that, Barry.
Christopher Bowen. Oh, it's only more than that. When I talk about it, I can't emphasize the depth of this. How it goes into the support of politics in Great Britain, in England, and the dealing in politics in the United States. I was
okay.
Telling someone,
well, thank you. Thank you for that, Barry. We'll let people.
Clintons. That were invited to this guy's home in New York.
Okay, hello? Barry, we're going to have to let you go. Thank you so much. Solving 9/11. That's a helpful thing. We appreciate your calling. And we've got Aaron back on the air. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hi, how are you, Paul?
Good. Yourself?
I'm well, thanks. I've been listening to you for a very long time, and I just love the quality of your voice. You're so empathetic sounding, and that's so rare these days from... you know, people on the air, as it were. Anyway, I want to go to a different topic altogether. I used to be an activist, and I fought the Patriot Act, and I fought Bush, and, you know, we went to our congressmen, we marched, and we did all this stuff. All of this is to no avail. We're losing the internet as well. All that is to say, in addition to whoever is in office, I don't think it really matters, even though the current one is a total... worthless person. It doesn't matter who's in anymore. I think the corporations were wholly owned by them in every respect, Paul. There's no getting around it. Now, that isn't even the point of my call. The point of my call is to tell you, I have since given up all the activation that I used to do to fight all these different bills, to fight all these different presidents, yada, yada, yada. But I have a son, and my son is despondent, and he's despondent because his heart is broken and he doesn't know it. He's living in an era that I never thought that I'd end up in. He's living in what's a near apocalyptic situation, and when we talk, he talks about the movies that he's watched or the books that he's read, and he says, in effect, Mom, you know, I'm ready to go anytime they drop the bomb. I said, but Eric, you're so young, you know? You have a life ahead of you. He said that what he's seeing is a total deterioration of the entire planet. It's only a matter of time. And it breaks my heart, Paul.
No, I hear you. I think those of us who are of our generation, I assume you're more or less closer to mine anyway,
we've...
Whatever, I mean, not, you know, there are parallels to the, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the time of the, you know, the nuclear bomb scare, people did feel like the world was ending. But there's something there's something different about this era that we've sort of maybe steeled ourselves from our experiences. But growing up must, I don't know, what you're saying reinforces a feeling I've had. I can't experientially get in that place myself because I am who I am, but no, I hear what you're saying.
But I think it's an extension of everybody else's feeling. I think we're all brokenhearted in this country. We used to be the beacon of light, Paul. You know, we are now totally the bottom of the pit of anything.
Well, the beacon of light. I mean, we should say that with a certain sense of irony.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's always been, you know, the alluded to pretend beacon of light, shall
right.
I say, because the masters of the universe are still always back there, you know, playing their little games. What I'm saying is we appear to the world to be somewhat better than their quality of existence on every level, however it was managed by the bad guys in the back room. But at least we were something for them to aspire to. And now they know that we're lost and they're despondent.
Well, unfortunately,
you know,
unfortunately, again, I have to just say that the aspiring to, unfortunately, was we see a totally flawed model, because at the time, you know, they aspire to the, you know, our technologies, our DDT and our nuclear
right.
weapons, our way of life. And that's, you know, that's what's now everybody's got. The internal combustion engine, and you know, China's gone capitalist,
yeah.
and so yeah. Anyway, it's a grim situation. Unfortunately, we to really get deep into this, which it's probably a should be a subject for a whole show.
I'd love it if you'd make it that.
Yeah,
know,
confronting despair and all that. Yeah,
because it's just I think it's pandemic. I don't think it's just limited here. I think the whole world is suffering because of Trump being the current. A puppet, you know, puppet du jour, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, listen to, James has also been waiting for a while, and I hate to come in the end of the show, we kind of have to sort of decide whether to get a lot of people or, but I'm going to have to let you go, and thank you for bringing that up, Aaron, and let's go to James. You might be our last caller. We only have a couple minutes left. Go ahead, James.
Okay. No, I really love this subject, and I think it's something that people really need to pay attention to, because you know, the West has been trying to gain a foothold in Islamic territory, Jewish territory, for a long time. And trying to take it by force, they've lost every time. So with the rise of the Messianic Jewish movement and other things, I mean, there has been a huge focus in the last 20 years to really convert Jews. And it's more than, I mean, really what it comes down to is, like you said, the Israel is tied into the end times. But it's deeper than that, in that the end times prophet, well, Messianic, there's a difference between Christian and Christianity and Judaism, and that Christianity believes the end times will begin when the Jewish people are able to make it into the Holy Land, but the Jewish people believe it'll be a time of universal peace when they can be back into the homeland. But if you read Revelation, you'll notice that the Antichrist actually bears a lot more resemblance to the Jewish idea of the Messiah than it does to some sort of satanic figure. But that's how they've always portrayed Judaism. I mean, all of Paul's letters were essentially just bashing Judaism in favor of this Gentile-based religion.
I wish you had called at the beginning. We could this... But anyway, the deep irony is that these evangelicals think that in order for Christ to return, all the Jews have to become Christians, and the powers that be in Israel, who are, you know, cynically, you know, using the evangelical support, have to sort of swallow that, I guess, for the time being. It's a very strange...
Not even necessarily swallow. I mean, maybe swallow it in a political sense.
Right.
But if you look at the capital and the influence, it's really the other way around. There's a lot of wayward Jews who want to go home, and a lot of these... And one thing a lot of people don't know is a lot of these white evangelical ministries have ministries set up for specifically sending Jews back to Israel.
Right, right. They're funding that.
Yeah, they're basically trying to finance the second coming.
Because so. I think there's this idea that there has to, half of the world's Jews or something have to be in Israel. There's really bizarre ideas out there, I tell you.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it, you know, and a lot of it is just like terrible readings of scripture.
Yeah.
That's why part of the Jewish scripture is oral and not written down, because they didn't want some other religions come along to steal their intellectual property. But Christianity has done quite a bit of that, and really to no avail, because of the fact that they don't understand. At every turn they've either neglected or outright fought Jews to be able to use their intellectual property, even to the point of burning their Talmud, Mishnah, and all their other oral materials that go explain deeper into the Bible, because the Bible is like speaking note cards for a great speech that Christians weren't there for, but the Jews were.
Hey, James, we got to go, and this is really the start of a fascinating conversation. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we could have you and I have a conversation sometime. I don't know if you want to leave your contact info with, you'd want to call me at the front desk afterwards.
Yeah, 231-833-2.
Anyway,
okay.
Anybody else, thank you for calling, James. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Good to talk to you as always. Anybody else want to talk to me at the front desk afterwards? I'm available unless there's, you know, a lot of traffic. We got to run. Thank you so much for listening. Paul Rowan, Wednesday Talk Radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The KABU Board of Directors meetings has been rescheduled to take place on Monday, May 21st at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Save the VA from Privatization on Wednesday, May 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Save the VA from Privatization, a forum of veterans, VA caregivers, and union activists, features prize-winning journalist Suzanne Gordon, who will discuss the value and importance of the VA healthcare system and the current threats to the VA from privatization and outsourcing. Again, that's Save the VA from Privatization on Wednesday, May 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning on the rest of the morning. First, it's Sojourner Truth Radio, today looking at the life of Kwame Truwe, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael.